I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of Health Cetera Radio. So 100,000 people are diagnosed every year with end-stage renal disease, and almost 500,000 are living with it. And about a quarter of these people are on dialysis. And today on Health Cetera, we're going to talk about what that means in terms of end-of-life decision-making. It's a topic that many people don't talk about, don't know about, and even clinicians seldom talk to patients about this issue. But it's a very important one, and the Coalition for Supportive Care of Kidney Patients has recognized how important it is to people and their families. And today we're going to be talking with two people who are working with the Coalition for Supportive Care of Kidney Patients to look at how to better prepare clinicians as well as patients and families on the important decision-making that needs to occur around end-of-life preferences when you are on dialysis. So let me first introduce today Dale Lupa, who is Associate Research Professor with the Center for Aging, Health, and Humanities at the School of Nursing at George Washington University and Strategic Advisor to the Coalition for Supportive Care of Kidney Patients. Dr. Lupa, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Very pleased to be with you.
And we also have Liz Anderson, who is a consultant and palliative care expert for the Coalition for Supportive Care of Kidney Patients. She's an assistant professor of social work at Western Carolina University. Liz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Liz, let's start off with you talking just briefly about what end-stage renal disease is. I think there are a lot of people who maybe have never even heard of that.
Sure. End-stage renal disease is essentially a product of kidneys failing, and I first learned of that in my own experience in hospice. So I think what's interesting about end-stage renal disease is there is treatment, which is dialysis, that can function for the kidneys. But one of the things that's tricky as we have this discussion is that prior to an end-stage renal disease diagnosis, people usually have a chronic kidney disease diagnosis, and chronic kidney disease often exhibits no symptoms. And so when we kind of frame this, what would happen in terms of being a hospice social worker when we would get patients with end-stage renal disease, it would come to them sort of as a shock. A crisis would occur, and so it wasn't as progressive as other illnesses.
And who's at risk for chronic kidney disease?
Well, I think most of the people that we see have diseases such as high blood pressure and diabetes that contribute to kidney failure. But we also know that certain populations are disproportionately affected by chronic kidney disease, including African Americans and Hispanic populations, and a lot of times people who typically do not have access to preventative care.
Which is one of the reasons why it's so important that people do have access to care that can help to diagnose early if you have kidney problems and to intervene, and as well as if you have hypertension to try to prevent, or diabetes, trying to prevent damage to the kidneys and not get to that point of end-stage renal disease. Then at end-stage renal disease is the time at which you're either going to, I assume you could have a kidney transplant maybe? Or go to dialysis.
Yeah. So there are several options for patients depending on, you know, their health at the time. And so some patients do have an opportunity to get a kidney transplant. Other patients choose hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis. And then other patients, depending on how sick they are at that point, might determine that they would like to go with a more conservative approach to managing pain and symptoms, but perhaps not filtering the kidneys.
Yeah, so let me jump in there, because we know that in other countries, the what's called conservative management or maximal medical management is offered to patients who might not do well on dialysis. We have in the U.S. about 110,000 people start dialysis every year, and the population 75 and older is the largest, the fastest growing segment of those folks starting. And while dialysis can work and can contribute both to increased length of life and better quality of life for somebody who's older and relatively healthy, the information that we have on dialysis for somebody who's quite old, quite frail, has other conditions, let's say heart problems, is that it doesn't necessarily extend their life, and it is a huge investment of time in terms of dialysis is something that you do typically three times a week for 4 to 6 hours. So it's a huge investment of time, and if it's not buying you either time or quality of life improvement, it's not something everyone wants to do. We've had patients who just express it as, you know, enough is enough.
Mm-hmm.
So while some people will want to try it, there are other people who are rather clear that they've seen friends or family members on dialysis and they know it's not something for them. And what we know from other countries that have maximal conservative management is that 10 to 15% of patients will want to choose that pathway. But that pathway is not very available here in the U.S. Most places don't have an organized way to really offer that pathway.
Now, let's just pause for a moment, though, and for people who may not know what dialysis is, Liz, you mentioned that there could be hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis, and today we're mostly talking about hemodialysis, correct? Because the peritoneal tends to be more short-term, correct? Or is it used long-term?
It is long-term as well.
So explain the difference. Explain what dialysis is and the difference between the two.
You want me to take that one?
I can do it. So there,
okay.
what dialysis is using a machine to filter your blood. Since your kidneys aren't taking out the waste products and aren't taking out the extra liquid to make urine, so it's filtering out the stuff that you don't need anymore. That's what your kidneys do for you. And the difference between hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis is kind of how that's done. And how much time you spend kind of hooked up to the machine and what kinds of processes are used to filter the waste products from your blood. Most people do hemodialysis where you go to a center 3 to 4 times a week and you spend about 4 hours with the machine filtering your blood. Peritoneal dialysis there are other forms of dialysis that can be done at home, and the family and patient then are managing the process, which for some people is quite good, and they like that, and they can do it at night. But for other people, it's a little scary. They'd much rather be doing that at the center where you've got nurses and doctors, medical folks right there to help you.
Yes. And I have to say that I'm hearing more and more of people who have been on hemodialysis. They go to the centers. It's, 3 or 4 times a week, sitting for hours. And initially, they may be fine with it because it's keeping them alive. If you don't have this filtering, you can die fairly quickly. But I'm hearing more and more of people who are saying it's just not the quality of life I want. That it diminishes the quality of life. You don't feel good. It limits what you can do. And more and more are opting to go to hospice care and say enough is enough. Is that's what the premise is here? That
right. Well, the premise of our project, the My Way project, is not to steer people to dialysis or away from dialysis, but really help people express what their values and preferences are. And specifically, this is a form of what we call advanced care planning. It's specifically to say, what would I want if I couldn't make a decision for myself? And so one of the things about dialysis that's unfortunate is something like 30 to 60% of people with end-stage renal disease develop dementia. So once that dementia begins to take hold, you may no longer be able to express your preferences as well, and you also may no longer be able to tolerate the treatments. We hear just really sad stories about somebody who's on dialysis, the dementia's progressing, they, let's say, are living in a nursing home and going to dialysis and not understanding what's happening and trying to pull out the dialysis tubes, but nobody feels that, well, you know, that they can stop it, because yes, stopping at that point would mean for that person that their kidneys couldn't function and they would die typically within about 2 weeks. So it's a big decision.
Mm-hmm.
But if you, as a person who are thinking you may go on dialysis, would think, if I were to get dementia, if I were to have a stroke and not be able to communicate, if I were to have a significant heart problem and then not be able to communicate, what is it that I would want? And some people would say, yeah, keep going, keep me on dialysis, do everything. And other people would say, no, at that point, I want to kind of accept the natural aging process, the natural process of coming to the end of life.
Mm.
And it's important to let people say what their values are.
So,
and I think to add to that, understanding, too, that that those decisions change throughout the lifetime, right? So, you know, our decision-making related to what our wishes are constantly evolving, and so making sure that healthcare providers are having that conversation along the way as people's needs change and evolve as well.
So aren't healthcare providers having those conversations? What do we know about that?
No, that's really the problem, is that we rarely do it. We know that it's something that should be done, but somehow in the busy setting of the doctor office and the dialysis center, somehow never seems to rise to the top. So when studies have looked at this for dialysis patients, so these are patients already with end-stage renal disease, already on dialysis, ranges from 6 to 38% of people who have done an advanced care plan have said, this is who I would want to make decisions for me. This is something about how I'm guiding them to make those decisions, you know, if I can't make them for myself in the future. And that's just, we think that's just not good enough, especially because when we ask patients about what they want, 90% of them say they want to have conversations with their nephrologist about end of life, and that it's one of their highest priorities. And yet, only 10% of people say they've ever had that conversation.
Wow.
So it's something that patients want, families want. They want to have the expertise and the help of their kidney team in thinking about this. But families don't necessarily know how to raise it. And so our project is to put a coach into the nephrology office who can actually sit down with the patient and family and work through the process of clarifying values and putting those into an advanced directive that's appropriate for their state.
And let me just remind listeners that that was Dr. Dale Lupa, Associate Research Professor with the Center for Aging, Health, and Humanities at the School of Nursing at George Washington University and Strategic Advisor to the Coalition for Supportive Care of Kidney Patients. And I'm talking with her and her colleague, Dr. Liz Anderson, Assistant Professor of Social Work at Western Carolina University, who's also a consultant with the Coalition for Supportive Care of Kidney Patients. And they are working collaboratively on a project called My Way. So tell us about My Way.
So My Way stands, you know, you have to have an acronym for projects like this. So it stands for Making Your Wishes About You. But it really expresses something that we think is important and that patients tell us is important, which is people have different ways that they look towards the decisions that might need to happen at the end of life. And as I said, some people will want every kind of technological intervention that they can have, and other people will say, no, enough's enough. Enough's enough, and let me just kind of have natural, leave me alone.
Yeah.
And So express, and what we know from research is that people think their families know that, or their decision makers know that, but they don't necessarily. There's actually surprisingly low agreement when we do some kind of testing between a patient and family member as to whether they understand the patient's wishes. So that's why it's really important to express it, to decide who you would want to be your decision maker, to talk with your decision maker, and to keep them updated, and then to put it in writing so that your doctor, your medical team knows who to be in touch with.
So a question here. For people who are on hemodialysis and go to the dialysis center, doesn't the dialysis center make sure that every patient has an advance directive or a plan that says who their healthcare proxy is, who will make decisions for them, and expresses what their wishes are?
You would hope so, but for instance, the Mayo Clinic just published an article where they did their own audit. Now, Mayo Clinic, you know, we know is a high standard of care, and they only found 49% of dialysis patients with advance directive in their record.
And I think it's also important to note that we have to recognize there is the possibility that some people never want to go on dialysis.
Right.
And if we're waiting to have that conversation until they go on dialysis, then people don't have that opportunity to make that decision prior to that.
So the My Way project is underway, and you are developing materials to prepare coaches for nephrologist offices, I would assume for other parts of the healthcare system like the dialysis center as well. You've also, though, developed a brochure that is relevant to patients, have you not?
Yes.
Liz
is the author, the main author. We've worked on it together, but Liz is the main author, and maybe, Liz, you can say kind of the approach that we took.
Yeah, so, you know, ultimately we felt like that there needed to sort of be a two-target method, so we needed to be able to reach patients and family members independently, and then we needed to be able to help the staff at a dialysis facility know how to have the conversation. And I think that's part of what is really interesting about this whole process. It's not that people don't want to have the conversation, it's that they don't know how to have the conversation, or the conversation doesn't go well. And so the patient education brochure that we developed is a step-by-step, a five-step process in which we outline for patients some areas to consider. And one of the things with my own social work background that was important to me was to consider like a motivational interviewing approach.
What is that?
So motivational interviewing is recognizing that people's readiness to change their behavior varies. And so sometimes people might be very ready to have a discussion about what are my wishes if I can't speak to myself, but other people might be very resistant to that. And if I go in and start talking to a patient that is very resistant to having that conversation, if I go in and say, hey, here's an advanced directive and here's why you need one, and I just give them a lot of information, that's going to be a turnoff. And so we have to meet the patient where they are. And instead of only informing patients of what they do, helping patients identify their own values and preferences. So getting them to begin to think about, you know, I have a new diagnosis, and what do I know about this? Do I know someone that's been through something like this before? And based on what I know, do I have any concerns? And kind of building upon that patient's experience. So being flexible with every single person that we interact with to meet their unique needs. And so motivational interviewing does just that. It's flexible. It is a model that involves asking open-ended questions that give a lot of information. It involves listening and offering reflective statements to make sure that you understand where the patient is, and to also demonstrate that you get it and get their perspective, and then informing based on where their needs are.
How do you do that in a brochure?
Yeah. well, so the brochure is designed in such a way that it doesn't just blast information out. Straight out to patients. So it starts out by asking, it gives a personal experience of a woman that has been through the chronic kidney disease process, and then it asks the patient to just consider their own thoughts and reflect on that early on. And then it goes through kind of normalizing that process for them. In a step-by-step fashion. So we look at the values, but we go into what is an advanced directive, what are some of the concerns that a person might have related to that, and how do we have a conversation with the people that we love.
Does it go into how to have the conversation with the nephrologist, how to bring it up with the nephrologist?
Step four is how to start the conversation, and that part is specifically with families and friends, but throughout the guide, we mention how important that is to be sure to have that conversation with your healthcare team.
So how can people get this brochure?
So right now, the brochure is available through the Coalition of Supportive Care for Kidney Patients, and it is free to download for anybody that wants to use that. I think ultimately we would love to see our nephrology offices have that brochure available for those patients as well.
And what's the title of the brochure?
The title of the brochure is Planning Today for Tomorrow's Healthcare, A Guide for People with Chronic Kidney Disease.
And the website is kidneysupportivecare.org.
One more time.
And there's kidneysupportivecare, all one word, kidneysupportivecare.org. And there's a menu at the top, and if you click on For Patients and Families, it has a choice for advanced care planning, and the brochure is downloadable right from that page about advanced care planning, along with a lot of other material for patients and families around advanced care planning and around chronic kidney disease.
Great.
And ESRD.
Great.
So it's a good resource.
So one last question as we run out of time here, and that is, Dale, I know that one of the premises here is that we now pay for conversations that will pay physicians, will pay, I believe, nurses, Liz, maybe social workers, to have conversations under Medicare, have conversations with patients about advanced care planning. And that's a fairly recent change.
Yes, 2016.
Yes, and so there has been discussion by the president and current Congress that rule should be undone. What happens if we no longer pay for that?
Well, I don't think that the payment is actually what is driving or not driving it. In truth, because physicians can charge for conversations regardless of the content. So a physician who wants to hold these conversations, it's part of medical planning and care planning, and so it'll be able to continue. What we'll lose is a kind of a legitimacy. When you have a code for something, it legitimizes that, yes, this is a real task. This is a piece of the work of the physician. Now we're talking all physicians, not just nephrologists. Mm-hmm. And they will lose this ability to bring in and pay for some of the time of nursing and social work in advanced care planning. So it would go back to being more dependent on the physician doing it, which is probably not a good idea. We probably need the physicians doing a piece of this, but having other team members help them. But I think the real pity would be kind of the lack of recognition of that this is an important part of the ongoing medical care, the ongoing relationship, which is the person saying, this is what I want.
Yes.
These are my values.
Yes. Well, look, I greatly appreciate the work you're doing in this area. It's really important. And for those of you who are listeners, if you know somebody with diabetes or hypertension, these are conversations that we all should have anytime, but those are people who are at risk anyway for chronic kidney disease, and if it's a family member of yours, you might want to start having conversations about their own preferences. And be proactive with your providers and let them know you want to have a conversation about your end-of-life preferences.
Absolutely.
So, yes.
Absolutely.
Well, so my thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Dale Lupa is Associate Research Professor with the Center for Aging, Health, and Humanities at the School of Nursing at George Washington University and Senior Strategic Advisor to the Coalition for Supportive Care of Kidney Patients. And the work that we've been talking about today is work that's coming, that this Coalition for Supportive Care of Kidney Patients is doing, and the project is called My Way. And Liz Anderson is a consultant for the Coalition for Supportive Care of Kidney Patients and an assistant professor of social work at Western Carolina University. Thank you both very much for coming on Health Cetera today.
Thank you so much.
And one more time, that website is www.kidneysupportivecare.org. Kidneysupportivecare.org. I'm Diana Mason. You're listening to Health Cetera on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City.